Welcome to On Strategy Showcase. I'm Fergus O'Carroll in Chicago. Here's a clip from today's episode.
I think the second mistake that can happen is when people don't go deep enough, and it's probably a symptom of the first mistake that I just talked about with the universal truth, that when you hear what you want to hear, you stop.
Right.
You know, and that's the confirmation bias. And it's just so easy to do it because it's in your brain, you hear it, and you're like, that's right. That's exactly what that is. And I'm really trying to teach my students that when they hear something that is contradictory or hear something that's surprising or hear something that doesn't make sense, go chase that because that's probably where the richness is.
That's Gina Fong, marketing professor at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management here in Chicago. She teaches a class to MBA students on ethnographic customer insights. Yeah, I know, MBA students having an interest in ethnography, something good must be going on here. This is a great partner episode with two others we produced last year. The first was Stephen Lacey's May 9th episode on the dangers of fishbowl thinking. And the second is our episode with Gunny Scarfo and Lindsay Waking of Nonfiction Research on July 8th. Now, all are great episodes to check out. Looking ahead to May, I'm thrilled to announce that we're going to be recording the show live from Dublin, Ireland on May 29th. Yes, I am returning to my hometown for what's going to be the first of many live show recordings in cities around the world. We're going to be discussing Irish creativity and its place in the world of marketing. There's a ton of good work that's happening over there, and not enough people know about it. So we're going to be talking about that. Guinness has been amazingly generous in hosting us. We're going to be in the Gravity Bar, which is literally on top of the iconic Guinness storehouse in Dublin. The Gravity Bar is a 360-degree glass structure that sits atop the roof. So I think it holds a couple of hundred people, so we're hoping to fill that. Info on tickets and guests will come in April. So it's the evening of May 29th. In Dublin. Try and block that on your calendar if you're over there. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can reach me on LinkedIn or at hello at onstrategyshowcase.com. Back to today, here's my conversation with Gina Fong of Northwestern University in Chicago. Enjoy. We had Stephen Lacey on the show from The Outsiders as part of our Outside In Thinking series. And Stephen talked about what he does as sort of, he defined it as semi-ethnographic research, because he doesn't go into necessarily a lot of depth, but he uses it in different ways and finds the technique is really useful. But he also mixes in quant and does other things. So I wanted to, I saw a post, I think one that Gina posted a while ago, and I reached out to her. She's here in Chicago at Northwestern University. And we had a conversation about ethnography. That was kind of what I was most curious about. And so she has been generous enough to join us today for this conversation. Thank you, Gina.
Well, thank you for having me.
So let's start off with something I noticed when I read an article that you had written. You said that in order to be successful, your students must transition from a place of knowledge to a place of understanding. That really resonated with me, because a lot of times in our industry, we see people who have come out of academic programs, either undergrad or MBA type programs, and they come into the industry, but they don't seem to really understand it in the marketing role. And I'm curious, is that the sort of distinction that you were driving at with your statement? Because is it a concern to you that we need to be able to be knowledgeable on things that we can apply?
Well, I'm so glad you're bringing this up, and you are very attuned to the details. So when I made that statement, I was actually giving the commencement speech at Kellogg's convocation. And so I'm in front of all of the graduates, and I think it's a pivotal moment for them. They have acquired a great deal of knowledge in these last 2 years, but now this transition has to take place where they have to use that knowledge. And I really wanted to impress upon them that this transition needs to happen for them to be successful. Now, aligned with that also is that I am a practitioner that is now a professor. So taking the practice and then coming in and teaching others is also really important to me. And then this idea that you need to take what you learned and then put it out in the world. So that comment that I made there was really to help them understand that it's just not good enough to have your education, that you actually have to use it. You have to apply it. You have to share it. And so that's what I meant by that comment there. And of course, this whole idea that we need to understand others to be successful, whether they are your customers, your loved ones, even complete strangers that you encounter in your life. That skill of understanding others is so critical, I think, to someone's success in personal and business lives.
So is that in a certain way an indictment of how we're teaching undergrads and grads? Is there something in that to be said that we need to sort of adjust the way that we're teaching in the modern world?
Well, I'm not privy to every classroom out there, but I do think, and I'm biased as an experiential learning instructor, that we do best as humans when we're learning by doing. And so there are classes, of course, that are going to be lecture-based. There are classes where there might not be very as experiential, but I think at some point we do have to roll up our sleeves and get to the doing. And that's what I wanted to remind the students of. And so I think that even if a particular course or class isn't highly experiential, that in a student's entire educational career, they should look for that balance overall.
Yeah, because I think a lot of us in this industry, if you think about agencies, when they go to market to try to get new business, they tend to leverage a process. And they promote that as if it's unique and that the outcomes will be unique as a result of this somewhat unique process that they follow with onboarding clients or with developing strategies, et cetera. But it seems a lot of time that we begin to force people to align with a process, but the process isn't necessarily playing to their strengths. In many ways, it's creating conformity, which is kind of the opposite of originality. And I think we're getting to grips with that a little bit in strategy worlds, in marketing, because we're saying that, in essence, we need to allow it to be more fluid for it to happen in ways that create unique outcomes. And I'm wondering, is that something that resonates with you? Because your work isn't structured. It has to have a level of fluidity to it.
It does. And I really love that you're bringing this up, because there is a balance of being prepared and being fluid. When I speak to my students about conducting ethnographic research, which they learn to do in my course, you need to be prepared enough. You just can't come and wing it. But you also have to allow some space and flexibility so that if something happens with a consumer that you weren't expecting, you can follow that. So it is a little bit of a balance. Now, to your earlier comment about these processes and these structures, I mean, I love a framework just as much as the next person. But I think sometimes what happens is we start to overuse the framework. And what I like to tell my students is I say, use the tool, don't let the tool use you. And again, it comes back to that balance of making sure that as the human in charge of this learning, that you are at the center and the tool is not at the center.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. That's a huge thing that we're dealing with, because I think there's sort of being this sense that if you don't follow the process, the process becomes so streamlined and predictable and comfortable that anything outside of the process is viewed as being sort of unnecessary, a distraction. And it seems that true understanding, at least in our world, in strategy and planning, true understanding isn't coming from the process, because the process is becoming automated. The process is becoming data-driven. Whereas many times true behaviors are not exposed in data, and you only get that by interacting with real people. Is that something, I would assume that's something that you would also advocate for?
Well, I think there's a little bit of a difference between data and what I do. So the way I like to explain it is that we've got a lot of quantitative data out there, and we need that quantitative data. That tells us the what. It identifies what's going on. But we also need the qualitative side, and that's the world that I sit in, and specifically in insight and motivation. And that explains the why. And you do need both. I'm not here to say that one is better than the other, because there are many times clients will approach me with work, and they'll say, we need qualitative research. And I say, you do, but I think you need to have some quant work done first. So there's this idea that really it's about a partnership. Now, of course, there's some discussion about which comes first, and that's going to happen in any situation, because that isn't something that is set in stone as well. But it is this marriage, this partnership of quantitative data and qualitative data, the what and the why. And when you get both, I think you're better able to create strategy and then ultimately implications and tactics that are resonating more with consumers.
So what do you think stands in the way of us truly understanding others today?
Oh, goodness. Well, where do I start? A few things. One, I think we make a lot of assumptions. We have hypotheses. And so it gets harder for us to just take that step back and come at something with a completely blank slate. And that is one of the things that my students are very surprised when they come into my class. I teach them how to conduct ethnographic research. And one of the first things they'll say to me is, okay, so what's our hypothesis? And I am the first to say, we don't have a hypothesis. We come in with an open mind and we follow the consumer. Because if we have a hypothesis, then we go into research most likely trying to prove or disprove it. And as soon as we do that, then we stop the research. We stop looking. And so I really want people to take that step back and just be very open about it. So when we come in with too many assumptions, too many hypotheses into research, that actually hurts us more than helps us, I think. The other thing I think, too, is that this is a practice that takes a lot of time. So unlike a survey that you can deploy and then wait for it to come back to you, someone's actually got to do ethnographic research. Someone has got to be in a consumer's home, watching them, talking to them, helping bridge those connections that need to be made. And it's not an incredibly scalable practice. So it is expensive and it is time consuming. So I think that also gets in the way sometimes, and that's understandable. And I think the other thing that can get in our way is that sometimes it requires a deep amount of empathy. And that is something that I think we are not always so practiced and skilled at. So if it's something that we're not good at, we tend to shy away from it.
So if it's not hypothesis that you start off with, what should you start off with?
You should start off with a good research question. What do you want to learn? That's the first thing I ask my clients when they call. They'll say, we need to do 10 ethnographies, or we need to do 6 focus groups. And I say, that's great. We might end up in that place, but let's take a step back. What do you want to learn? And then and we'll go from there. We might end up in the place that you expected, but we really have to start there. So coming up with a great research question is a good starting point.
And what's an example of that? Is there one that you could share with us that you feel is a really great example of a great research question?
Let me tell you what a bad one is first. So a bad research objective would be something like, let's determine which ad is the one we should air. And I say that's a bad research objective because what you're doing is you're expecting the research to make the decision for you.
Right.
And really, research is an input to making the decision. Research shouldn't make the decision for you, but it should provide clarity and confidence into that decision. So a better research objective might be something, understand the consumer's motivations when using XYZ product so that we can understand how to be more relevant to them. And that learning helps you figure out, gosh, did this ad really work or not, and why? And do we need to go back to the drawing board and figure out something else?
So is it in essence exploring the why versus the what?
Absolutely, absolutely. Data, I say that data identifies the what and insight explains the why. So that quant versus qual tension there.
And is that difficult that you find in your work? Because I can imagine there's a lot of whys that people want to explore. And this is where the expertise of the researcher, whether it's in quant or qual or any other methodology that falls out of them, that's the thing. You have to wrangle expectations. You have to simplify. You have to hopefully get it down to maybe one or two whys. Why is this happening? Why is that happening? Is that a challenge for you too in that world of ethnography, not only explaining what you're doing, but explaining and building expectations for what will come out of it?
Absolutely. I think in any given project, there's always a little bit of project creep, but what we're always trying to do is maximize things. And as people get more excited about the research, they'll say to me, oh, can we add this in? Can we add this in? Can we figure out this? And again, I go back to the research objective. What are we trying to learn? Because that will hold us accountable and make sure that we are being focused. So if they say something like, oh, I know we're going to study and learn how people are washing their floors, but can we just sneak in this other product and figure this out? And it has nothing to do with washing floors. I might say, you know what, that's a little bit too much for the research. We might need to do a separate study for that. But again, going back to what do you want to learn?
We'll be right back.
Hi there, my name's James Herman, and I'm what's known as a distinctive asset, which is something that makes people think immediately of a certain brand, like the Golden Arches make people think of McDonald's, or the Swoosh makes people think of Nike. When the most effective marketing and advertising people hear me, they think of the Master of Advertising Effectiveness brand. The Master of Advertising Effectiveness is a 6-week online program in partnership with WARC, where I'll give you a next level understanding of how to make advertising that creates consistently better commercial results. One important ingredient is distinctive assets, like me. And me being here on this ad is one of the many reasons this campaign is
the most effective advertising campaign in the world.
Confused? You won't be when you become a Master of Advertising Effectiveness. Get started at mae.academy. That's mae.academy.
Now back to the show. What we're struggling with a lot in working as strategists and site agencies, and clients are too on their side, we're all referencing the same trend reports, the same quant studies, the same syndicated research. And I think there's a level of burnout that's happening now because we're hearing it more and more on the show, where everybody has the same content and clients are struggling to find something unique that they can own themselves. And I think it's wonderful that we're starting to see places where clients are willing to sort of adopt less sort of structured research techniques, less formal in their execution, because they're beginning to realize that the unlocks are the observations, the findings that come out of qualitative research, ethnographies and other methods, are very rich, can lead to far better work and far better strategies. And I'm curious, do you notice that?
I agree with you. Everyone's having access to the same reports. And now that we're in a very data-driven world, there's a lot of repetition in terms of what we're collecting. But again, because people aren't as invested in ethnographic research as much because of the time, because of the money, because there aren't as many people that are skilled at doing that versus maybe the data side of it. When you do ethnographic research, boy, it gets back to those nuances and those details that if you get that right, a consumer knows that you really understand them. I mean, when you think about it, you go to a coffee shop and the person that sees you every morning go in and order your cup every day, when they do that little something to your coffee that only they know how to do. You know, that's what keeps you loyal to that coffee shop and that barista. And again, in ethnographic research, when you can pick up on those nuances and those details that perhaps your competitors aren't, boy, you earn a lot of credibility with your consumers.
Do you believe that the techniques of ethnography have changed over the years? Are they adapting? Are new ways of doing things happening? And if so, what are some of those changes?
Well, I have been doing this for a long time. So I was trained before there was technology, before there was Google. So I liken it to, I learned how to cook, you know, over an open fire or the stove. And now we've got some really fancy gadgets coming up in the research world. And so one of the tensions, I think, is, and brought on by the pandemic, is that to do a digital ethnography. And is how is a digital ethnography different from being in person? And there are tons of differences. Now, I did digital ethnographies during the pandemic because that's what was available to us. And that was better than not doing any research at all. But there is something about being in person that can't be replaced, because when I get to a person's house, I'm doing the research before I even meet them, driving into their neighborhood, coming onto their block, seeing how their lawn or their front house looks, the cars in the driveway, so on and so forth, the welcome mat that's on their doorstep. And then once I'm inside their house, really being able to see things from my point of view, not their point of view. If I'm doing a digital ethnography and we're on some sort of digital platform, I see everything through their camera lens. And then I'm not seeing things with that step back where I could look in their home and say, hey, I'm noticing this over here. Can we talk about this? That is not accessible to me. And so that's probably the biggest difference I'm seeing over the years, is that we're using more digital tools. And in a lot of ways, they're very good, but in some ways, they can't be replacements for being with someone one-on-one in person.
Yeah, I 100% agree. For me, I think there's such immense richness that comes out of it. And the only downside that I see happening now is that not all clients, our client organizations, are ready to accept the feedback of 20 people over the feedback of 200 people in a quant study. I mean, is there something that you have discovered where you're able to sort of create more of an acceptance for a smaller sample being more indicative of a large opportunity?
The way I explain it is that when you're going into understand insight, someone's motivation, it's not necessarily about the sample size in total. It's really about how many people do you need to study to identify the motivation of these people? You get to a certain point and you start to see the pattern of repetition. They start saying very similar things. They start complaining about the same things. They start buying the same things because they're up a learning curve.
Do you then think it's necessary in your work to then quantify that? Or do you feel comfortable with the qualitative identifying, you know, the problem or the opportunity through qualitative measures?
It really depends on the client. So what I have given the client then is the why, but a lot of companies still need to know, well, how many operate like this? And I'm qual, so I don't do the quant work. And so then I hand the baton off to a quant researcher, and then they help the client figure out, well, how many people out there are behaving like this and how much money are they worth? And then that gets you to a much richer analysis.
We found that a lot of times, given the fact that there's so many digital tools out there, that expertise is being discounted in research. That there's a general sense that because you've got a platform where you can just add in your own questions and you can field it against a random, so-called potentially random sample, that anybody can now do it. The confusion between expertise and tool is extremely distinct. And I'm wondering, is that the same in ethnography?
Well, I think like anything, what looks like it's fun and easy on the surface,
yeah,
then is assumed that it must be easy and fun to do. I can't tell you how many people have seen me do my job and they're like, wow, this must be fun. You're just talking to people. But of course, behind the scenes, there's more than just talking to people. You're not just having a conversation. There's so many things going on in my brain that I'm holding on to, observing, questions that I want to ask, paths that I want to go down and explore. And so it's not just that you're talking to someone else. Now, on the flip side of that, I don't want to scare people off from talking to their own consumers just because they're not a professional or not trained in this practice. I think everybody should get closer to the consumer. And frankly, this isn't, we're not conducting surgery. So no one is going to die on an operating table if you ask a question out of place, if you stumble along in the conversation, if you ask a leading question. But yes, of course, there are standards in this practice. And when I teach my students, I teach them in a certain way of how to ask questions, how to be curious, how to be empathetic. But I would rather people get to know their consumer than hold back because they think only experts can do it.
And so what are the risks to companies of not including this sort of ethnographic, qualitative work as part of the overall research approach?
I think there's a danger of being a bit superficial in your knowledge of your consumer. One of my students said something to me last quarter, and that is, she said, I always thought that the data, the what, was good enough. But I realize now the data, my consumer eats 5 candy bars a week, isn't enough to tell the complete story. We don't know why they're eating 5 candy bars a week. So getting to that deeper layer is really critical, because when you understand the why into someone, then you can predict a lot more things about them. And you don't have to go back and you don't have to keep doing research. Every time you make a superficial change to your brand experience or your product, you're left wondering, well, is this going to be good enough? Is this really what we need to do? And then you might feel the urge to go back and test it. But if you understand your consumer deeply, you understand the why behind it, then you know exactly what you have to design. You know exactly what you have to do to surprise and delight your customers.
So when that gets translated to quant, do you ever worry that the observation that you made in qual is diluted beyond recognition when it's described in a question in a quantitative survey? Because the observation of human behavior and the way that you then try to, you know, frame a question that would result in whether or not that's a shared behavior, that's an enormous skill. Do you ever worry about the fact that if somebody's trying to quantify the behavior and they say, hey, it didn't actually pan out, not a lot of people agreed with you, that it wasn't because people didn't agree, it was about how the question was posed to them?
Yeah, I think what's really important in that situation is to make sure, as you say, the question is posed correctly. And that involves having the qualitative researcher involved, because they were the one
that was.
And so you can't just say, okay, go design here, quantitative researcher, go design the survey. It really is that partnership. And I work with quantitative researchers very closely. If a client comes to me and says, we have this thing we have to figure out, I might say to them, you should probably do the quant work first, and I should come after that, but I should be a part of the quant work, just so that anything that's being done there is going to serve me when I have to do my phase. Sometimes I come first, and then the quant folks are with me because they know that whatever I'm doing, they have to carry the baton forward into their work. So I think there's a real value in making sure your qual and your quant researchers are working together. So when you make that handoff, it's really smooth and you don't lose anything in that translation.
What are the common mistakes made when conducting or interpreting ethno and other qual results?
Well, I think one of the bigger mistakes I see is when people get to a universal truth and feel like that's the big aha. Again, you know, people want to have clean homes. Of course they do. If everyone can say that, then it's probably not something really sticky and nuanced that will lead to great strategy. So that's probably the first mistake, that you do all this research and you come back and it's what I call an evaporating insight, where it just goes poof in the air because it's this universal truth. I think the second mistake that can happen is when people don't go deep enough, and it's probably a symptom of the first mistake that I just talked about with the universal truth, that when you hear what you want to hear, you stop.
Right.
You know, and that's the confirmation bias. And it's just so easy to do it because it's in your brain, you hear it, and you're like, that's right. That's exactly what that is. And I'm really trying to teach my students that when they hear something that is contradictory or hear something that's surprising or hear something that doesn't make sense, go chase that because that's probably where the richness is. People may not always make sense to you, but they always make sense to themselves. And that's really what you want to study.
What are the characteristics of a great ethnographic researcher?
Yes. So there are a couple of things, and I teach them in class. So as I mentioned before, being incredibly curious. And to me, curiosity is wonder without judgment. So not really imposing an opinion, just simply being and letting people be. And then to be introspective. And my students usually get a little thrown off when I teach them introspection in the course because they say, well, we're here to understand other people. What are we doing with introspection? And I say, well, to understand others, you have to understand yourself first. And that's really what ethnography is. You're coaching someone to introspect. So in addition to the observation, you've got to have this rich discussion, but it can't just be about the what. It has to be about the why. And it means coaching to someone to introspection. So curiosity, being introspective, and then being able to have empathy for someone. You know, you have to be able to hear someone's story or their pain and say, I'm going to be able to do something about this. I understand it, and I'm going to fix it for you.
I mean, it's part psychology, it's part sociology, and those are not characteristics that I typically associate with an MBA grad student. And those are the people that I believe you're teaching. How responsive or open to it are they? And what are they skeptical of?
Well, surprisingly, they're incredibly open to it. One, because I do have a little bit of a curated audience. I'm an elective. So anyone that comes through my course is actively choosing it.
Nice.
Now, it's not to say, though, that it's easy for them. They get in, and I think they think this is going to be a cool class because they're going to talk to other people and just get to know consumers, which is true. But again, as I alluded to before, there's a lot of work that goes on behind that. There's a lot of preparation. And then there's analysis that needs to be done. Just because you talk to someone doesn't mean all of that knowledge just comes bursting forth in an articulate way. So I think they're very interested in it. A lot of MBA students are incredibly curious, and that's what I love about the students that come through my course. But it really is about, if I can use this analogy, it's like picking up a tennis racket, but now you've really got to learn how to hold it properly and know where to place your feet and how to follow through.
It is Gina Fong, consumer anthropologist at Fong Insight and marketing professor at Northwestern University here in Chicago. Thank you, Gina. I hope you'll come back on again as we continue to explore this and we'll dig in even deeper.
Oh, I would love to. Thank you so much.
And we'll see everyone on the next episode.